Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And today we're here with Ian Bourne from IRB Developments. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. Thanks for having us.
I'm very excited. It's
good. Well, it's been an exciting day, hasn't it, in many respects?
Yes.
Which will all be revealed very soon. But we're here. We've done a bit of video this morning, haven't we, for the YouTube channel? Some currency may have changed hands for a vehicle, just keeping that under our hat for now, but keep an eye on the YouTube channel because it's quite an exciting little day out, I think, isn't it?
But for the record, it's not out of my pocket, so I don't mind.
It's not out of mine, it's fine.
Yeah.
So I just use one person around this table whose pocket some money has.
Yeah. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that today. We're going to talk a little bit about, Ian, your history with Land Rover and how you've come to get into the business and what, you know, what it is you do now, because you've obviously quite well decorated in terms of cover cars. You've had quite a few, haven't you?
I think I have. I think it was six at the moment.
Mate. Six?
Yeah, I think it's six. Soon to be seven, hopefully, we'll see.
Yeah.
That's... I don't think there's anyone that's beaten that, is there?
Not that I can think of.
No, I think it's six.
Yeah, it's quite a few. Yeah.
Over quite a few years, obviously. Yeah. But so where did it all start with you and Land Rovers? Let's start from the very beginning.
So Land Rover started because my parents always had them. So I've got three brothers and we needed a car that could get six people in with mum and dad and the brothers. So my dad had a Series 2A and then not long after we changed that to a Series 3 and then he went to Discovery and Freelander eventually and that sort of rubbed off on me. So I had a Series 3 as my first car. So oh, okay. 8-inch when they were cheap.
When they were cheap. Yeah, that's quite some time ago now. They're still out there, but a good one is proper money now, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, 750 quid, my first one, I think.
Was it?
MOT'd on the road.
God.
In what, 1998?
I remember actually looking through all the classifieds in the Land Rover magazines, and it, like you say, running, driving on the road, MOT'd. They're like sub £1,000 all day long.
Used to be many features in the mag, wasn't there? What, the Land Rovers you could buy for £1,000, MOT'd, 2A, Series 3s, commonplace, just... Which those days came back, really.
Well, you used to see the fields of the military ones as well, and they were 1,500 quid from like Jackson's and Blanchard's and Leavesley's. They were next to nothing.
Yeah. Disposable vehicles at the time.
Well, they're all being snapped up and restored, and sort of people are putting their own stamp on them now. So we can't complain. It's still good.
Yeah,
they're still a good entry point into the brand as well. But so how do you obviously done your, you did your time with Land Rover itself?
Well, with Jaguar, so I did my A-levels and then didn't really want to go to university, so I applied for apprenticeships. And at the time, Jaguar and Land Rover were two separate companies and they both accepted me. But Land Rover could only offer me an apprenticeship in maintenance, which is not what I wanted to do. And Jaguar said, we've got some placements in powertrain development. So in prototype development, if you want to come with us, that's where your placement will be. So that's what I did. So I went to Jaguar. Then obviously as Jaguar went on in 2000, well, just after I started, it was sold to Ford. And then in 2003, I think it was, BMW sold the Rover Group. They split the Rover Group up. And then Land Rover came to us. And then in 2008, when Tata came along, it became the JLR brand.
Oh, right. Okay.
So my early days were Jaguar. And then we knew people from Land Rover, but it was very two separate, very defined companies.
Right, got you. I wasn't aware of that. But yeah, no, I suppose there would have been some overlap with regards, like you say, powertrain.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Obviously, the two have been interchangeable, certainly in more recent years.
Yeah, but it's only the early 2000s. It was two separate brands. They were quite different. And Jaguar were really anti-diesel. So when I started Jaguar, there was very much, Jaguar makes petrol cars. We don't make diesels. We're not interested. We make petrol engines.
Crikey. And now we're just to electric.
Yeah.
So there's that.
So what are your thoughts on the current state of affairs at Jaguar?
Well, it was all a joke. That was apparently that's what they announced, wasn't it? I think one of the things they said, oh yeah, we didn't quite mean it the way it came out.
Do you think though that now, because there's such a negative vibe, that they've backpedaled?
Well, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
No, there is that. They certainly got people talking.
Yeah.
They say. But yeah. Okay. So how then did you go from powertrain development on Jag? What followed after that?
So obviously mainly my apprenticeship. So I went through all of powertrain sections, so engine build, vehicle workshops, emissions testing, engine testing, and then going on numerous trips, going out to support different test engineers. And I basically worked my way through the company. It became JLR. So I suddenly got more interested because then I was working on the Land Rover brand as well.
Okay, so you were still more interested.
Yeah, so I was definitely still green on the inside, but I didn't want to go on maintenance. That wasn't interested in the slightest.
Yeah, okay.
And then yeah, just worked my way through powertrain, and I did my degree, and then applied for a staff job. So ended up as a senior engineer for JLR, working on both brands.
Oh, cool. So what sort of projects did you oversee on Land Rover side?
All sorts of stuff. So early Jaguar stuff was quite interesting because before Land Rover came along, it was obviously part of the Ford group, which meant we also got some random American cars. So there was a Lincoln that we used to have that had a Jaguar V8 in the front as a front-wheel drive. She had this massive Lincoln car and it was front-wheel drive. It was the weirdest thing in the world.
Wow. I've heard of a couple of American cars that have like that weird longitudinal V8 but front-wheel drive. Is it North Star V8?
Yeah, well, I'm sure in the Lincoln, it was east-west. It was the other way around.
Really?
A massive deep engine bay.
That is odd.
It was really weird.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And then obviously we had Aston Martin as well then. So at one point we were doing some of the DB9s. I can never remember the Aston Martin numbers, but that had a Jaguar engine in. So there's quite a few changes, but it was actually a Jaguar V8.
Okay. Got you. Yeah, there's quite a few similar. Well, again, everything's a bit shared.
Really, the V7 is particularly a bit XJS-y, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what else? I don't know what else to do. So I did my apprenticeship, and then I came out of my apprenticeship. I went down to engine test. So day in, day out, I'll be running an engine dyno, and I sort of got all the special projects. So early on days, we had a single cylinder. So when Jaguar developed an engine, they wanted to look at the emissions data and how it started and any early information they could get. And it was much easier to build a single cylinder version of that engine than a multi V8. So they'd literally take a V8, look at the internals and make a one-off tiny little block and tiny little cylinder head and allowed us to run a single cylinder version of that engine.
Wow. I guess that still must have been indicative enough of what the rest of the engine would be like, even though it wasn't there.
No, it was, in reality, just to get early information. So we used to spend loads of time looking at spark plug depth, spark plug angles, injector angles, length of injection to make the engine start. And then all that early data then got passed on to the multi-engine so that they could literally put it on a test bed and make it start and run, but not necessarily optimise in any sense, but they can make it start and run from the data they gained from the single cylinder.
That's mad, isn't it? That's clever.
Yeah.
I bet the tooling in that, the single cylinder units are probably highly collectible now.
I don't know if it's still there because I haven't been back for a while, but it didn't look anything like an engine. It was literally a block of steel and aluminium with an exhaust and inlet, and then we play around with different inlet ports and manifold lengths just to get that early information about the engine.
Wow.
How long was the process then between that stage to the actual engine being manufactured?
I think most of the time we're a little bit behind, so I think they'd already started work on manufacturing, but we were still getting the data from that early level stuff. Okay. And I think we did an SAE paper, so there's a data paper that I get mentioned in that we were just doing early stratified injection and playing around with the injection process.
Okay, so at what point did you decide I've had enough of this, I want to do
anything? Well, in all honesty, I'd always got an interest in Land Rovers. I'd always had Land Rovers. And during my apprenticeship, I'd start doing little bits and pieces for friends and working on friends and family's cars and look after my parents' car. And sort of in 2017, for various other reasons, I decided that I couldn't keep doing both because my daughter came along. Well, 2018, I had an only little girl, and I couldn't keep doing the JLR side of stuff and then doing all this outside of work. So 2018, JLR offered me VR, and I took the leap, basically, because I'd already got a customer base of sorts set up that I was doing part-time that I could then leap and do full-time.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
So it was a family work-life balance, really. I couldn't keep doing both.
Yeah.
Okay. When I had a little girl, I just couldn't support it.
Yeah. That must have been quite a, like you say, even though you had that perhaps a bit of a cushion from the redundancy, it must have been hell of a leap.
Yeah, it was a big jump.
Yeah. Well, you're already in 25 now. You've found your feet fairly swiftly, yeah, though.
Well, in all honesty, I was already sort of established, but
it was
a jump, yeah. I'd already had a few front covers and that, obviously all the Haynes manual stuff that we did with Lindsay Porter, all that was already out.
Hush. Do you remember Lindsay Porter?
No, I remember reading his stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
That's very much.
Yeah, so we did loads of technical articles for Land Rover Monthly, and then it appeared as a Haynes manual.
Did you get bored of fitting LED lights for Lindsay Porter?
There's lots of funny stories. Lindsay's a very nice bloke, but there's lots of very funny stories you could tell.
Yeah, he's probably the most lit up Defender 110 you could ever have.
He likes some lights around the place, does
it? It doesn't exist. He sold that car. It's got a Cummins in there.
Okay.
I still see it on social media, but it's been sold on.
Interesting. Yeah, it's yeah. You say so. Cover car wise, what have you had? You've had the 2A, which is the TDCi Puma powered. That is the most recent one, I think, before I started on the mag. And since then, you've had that really nice OEM plus 110 Defender, the green constant green one.
Yeah, well, yes, it's a mix of a British Rail colour green, special green.
You built that one, didn't you?
Yeah, I built that from scratch.
There's
matte walls, grey, twisted style. It was basically modifying your Defender in a weekend.
Yeah,
I remember we literally had a big pile of bits and we put them all together.
I didn't know if you were involved in that or not. It was a great feature. I remember
it was good. That was actually photographed here as well. And then I've had, obviously, ORE Chris's car that Chris built in 6 weeks with no help at all. But
well, yeah, as evidenced in our podcast with Chris, you can fight about that afterwards.
Chris panicked, didn't he? He's like, because anyone that's listened to our previous podcasts with Chris on it, he explains why that project came about and why basically
it snowballed so hard.
Yeah, but we put him under pressure.
Yeah.
We put Ian under pressure.
Yeah, I was going to say, by proxy, Ian felt the brunt of that pressure more than anyone else, possibly
a little bit. And I think early before that, there was a TD5 as well. There was a red TD5. There used to be a lad called Fruity, did tractor pulling. And we built a very high-powered 240 horsepower TD5 back in the day.
Is this when the fastest Land Rover was around? Is that back then?
Yeah, so that's the 2007, 2008 period.
I was going to say.
When tuning was like everyone was trying to get the most power.
I remember vividly a feature in Land Rover Monthly, and it was one of yours, and I think possibly Pete Bell's one went up against each other. It was 290s, I seem to remember. I may be wrong.
No, that wasn't mine. So back in the day, I used to do quite a bit of work with Pete.
Oh, okay.
And then we went our different ways because we both perhaps had slightly different approaches to tuning.
Right.
So back in the day, it was quite a bit. I did stuff I did with Pete, and then we sort of split and went our separate ways.
Right, okay.
But early days, there was quite a bit of joint venture work. So the red TD590 was mine and Pete Bell.
Because there was quite a lengthy phase, really, of people highly tuning TD5s in Defenders, but they'd also go with slightly lower suspension and often like 22-inch alloys. Yep. That was like a real thing, wasn't it, in the sort of...
I think it's 2007 we did the fastest Defender, I think. Wasn't it a Brunswick?
I think it was before then.
Was it?
Oh, hang on. It was probably 2000.
That's when we had like the Grey Zulu. We had Twisted's driver set the course up and then drive it as well for Twisted. And then they did the timekeeping as well, which is slightly odd.
No comment.
That's opening a whole old can of worms.
It was a good day, though. It was interesting to see that side of that business is actually carried on now because there's still quite a demand for road bias Defenders.
Yeah.
So that period, it was very popular.
Yeah, we always thought, when's this bubble going to burst? And it was like over a period of time. But to think that was like 18 years ago.
Well, back then, I seem to remember, because I was still avid Land Rover magazine reader throughout.
We're not probably dissimilar in age, are we? I don't think either.
I'm 34.
Oh, yeah, you're quite a bit younger than me then.
We were similar age.
Yeah. Oh, you're 50, dear.
Yeah.
I'm only 43. There's no way, dear.
Oh, God. What does that say about me?
Yeah.
Were you...
But I've hard paper.
Yeah, it's tough paper.
That's the stress of working with Steve, that is.
It is, yeah.
But
we've only spent a whole day together.
It seemed, don't I know it. It seemed like at that time you had the highly tuned road buyer stuff and then at the other end you had the real extreme winch challenge stuff and there was very little. I mean, green laning obviously was around and people did
I think winch challenge was a massive scene back then, though. It was a lot bigger than it perhaps is now.
It was huge.
Yeah,
because you could get a Land Rover and bolt stuff to it and you'd be competitive, whereas now it's all tube-frame buggies and, you know, there's a lot more custom fabrication. You know, companies exist building them for a living, do you know what I mean? It's not like you can get a 90 and put lockers and winches on it and dominate. It doesn't happen anymore.
No.
You're not going to be competitive now for, anything under 100 grand, are you?
No,
probably not. But then... times move on, don't they? And
because it's strange, where obviously in the background, you've got Comp Safari, which never features that much in all the magazines to any extent.
Think actually we're probably gonna hill rallies, especially because they're really having a comeback now.
Yeah.
Since the Welsh one, they've obviously had the Scottish one, and there's another one happening this year. We'll have to really concentrate on giving them a bit more coverage because they really deserve it. The amount of effort that goes into planning hill rallies is incredible.
Because obviously you've got like Ed Cobb in the British Off-Road Championship, but you don't see that much Comp Safari stuff in it. Even back in 2000 and the early 2000s, it was very popular. You just didn't see it as much. I think if you're in that, not clicks the wrong word, but if you're in that group of people,
yeah,
it was very much at the forefront.
Yeah, in fact, we've almost had a whole podcast on trialing, didn't we? And how that sort of seems to have dwindled a little bit in recent years. And I think it is still popular. You just don't see it as much. And maybe we should be doing more to drive that, the whole motorsport side of it, really.
But back in the day, you would see it, but it would be all over the magazines.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. And now, because it's not Overland of the Month, you probably don't, unless you're in that circle.
Potentially, yeah.
You're talking private Facebook groups and things like that. You're probably not sharing it with the world, are you?
Maybe. Yeah, it's hard.
So I think my most popular video on YouTube was one of the Comp Safari cars I did.
Oh, right.
So back in, I don't know what that would be, 2008 or 2009-ish, we put a 4.2 supercharged Jag engine in the back of a Land Rover. That was an impressive thing, and that's probably one of my most popular videos on YouTube still. That's been at the bottom of the listings for ages. Never so often it pops back up.
So if anyone wants to check that out, what's your YouTube page?
IRB Developments.
Okay.
Yeah.
We heard it here first.
Definitely, yeah.
Because not I've ever done that much on YouTube, but
I was going to say that following on from that craze, really, of highly powered TD5s, there was a sort of quite a time period where it was trying to integrate TDV6s and things like that into Defenders out of like Discoveries. And do you remember when all that was like kind of popular? And did you ever have much to do with that? I suppose with your experience with engines.
I did start putting a TDV6 into a Defender, but it's never finished it, in all honesty.
Right.
Unfortunately, customers' cars get in the way. It's quite hard sometimes to do development work and make stuff I think is really interesting. But initially, that doesn't pay the bills because you don't make any money until that comes to fruition and gets sold. So sometimes you have to just do the normal customer cars to get that money in.
Yeah,
and cash flows. It's quite hard. It's only me. There's only one of me, which people don't realise sometimes.
Looking around your workshop, you certainly look like you've got a fair bit on.
Yeah, there's a few cars.
In all the workshops I've been in, and this is probably the most tool heavy.
There's a little bit of mech tools in here, yeah.
There is a lot of toolage.
Cool, yeah, well, other bands are available, but there's quite a bit of mech tools.
Of course, yeah. All right, well, what would you say then? Because we're not really in a position anymore to give professional advice on this, but if you're just starting out and you want to learn and develop skills on a Land Rover, what do you think the best sort of basic tool setup is that you can buy as someone who does it every day?
There's a few brands, so there's the normal. The Halford stuff is actually not bad at all.
Yeah.
I've still got some Halford stuff from when I was an apprentice. And then you've got the likes of Draper, which is Mac Tools, is like entry-level tool range.
Right.
It's still got guarantees in it. There's a company called Sonic, which is a company based in the Netherlands. Again, really good tools for the money. I don't think there's any one manufacturer you should buy all your tools from.
Yeah, you're right, I think.
Because you need a spread of... There's some stuff that I've got that perhaps, it isn't Mac, it's other makes. It just varies on job to job. And then obviously with Land Rover stuff, there's lots of specialist tools. So then you're into like Laser Tools, who do a lot of stuff. Sykes Picavan do quite a bit for Land Rovers. It's picking and choosing.
Yeah, Laser especially. I know Britpart sell some of their stuff. And Sykes Picavan, like the, dealer level, I guess, special tools, which a lot of, certainly Defender onwards, you really struggle without on certain jobs. It all depends what you're doing, doesn't it? That's the long and short of it is just, like you say, shop around, talk to people as well, get an idea what they think is best to use, and then sort of find your way from there. But
so obviously with modern Land Rovers as well, it's not just physical hand tools you need, it's software as well. And diagnostic tools. And then if you start getting into the tuning world, there's a whole different level of tool again.
So how did you get into tuning?
So mainly for being on test beds at JLR. So a lot of the time we're doing calibration work, and it just interested me. So outside of work, then I'd start playing. Almost using the experience I gained at JLR, and then I'd use that knowledge to start modifying stuff because I found it interesting.
That's really cool. I suppose in the early days it was certainly with the TD5s, you have to take the ECU to take the EEPROM.
Yeah, so physically change the chip and then put a new chip in. It's only later that they became flashable. Right. And you'll find now that even some modern cars you can't tune because they've got too clever with software and nobody's cracked that code yet.
Okay, interesting.
So where's the cutoff then in Land Rover products?
Yeah. Most Land Rover stuff you can do, but then Land Rover have tried to be clever along with other manufacturers because they start putting protection in. The ECU can start detecting that it's got the wrong software in because it does software over the air, so a SOTA, and it starts looking at what should be on the car and what is on the car. It does a comparison. So manufacturers have tried to make it harder and harder to stop tuning. Right. So like modern Ford Transits, you can't tune yet because no one's cracked the software because Ford have made it harder to do.
Okay. Interesting.
But then there's a whole business in trying to crack ECU software. So there's companies that specialise in doing nothing but making... They're not interested in physically tuning the car. They're just creating the method that people can upload and download files. So you can upload the standard file, modify it and put it back. And that's the hardest thing. It's not so much... the hard bit is tuning and making the performance gain. But a lot of the time it's getting software that can read and write in a way that doesn't kill the ECU.
Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Because those manufacturers don't want you to do it. There's lots of implications, so manufacturers try and stop it.
Yeah. It's funny, I always smile whenever I see, certainly social media, someone asks who they should get their X tuned by, and it's like putting the cat among the pigeons because
Everyone's got their own customer base. I think sometimes some other tuners perhaps get a bit emotional, and I think there's enough people for everyone. I don't really understand why everyone gets so worked up about why you have to go here.
Yeah.
You make your own decisions, don't you? You read up, you see people's experience and everything else and make your own view.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
I think the Land Rover market's big enough for enough people, but there's certain companies that get very excited about, oh no, I have to control all of this. I have to do this. I am the best. You don't do that, it's wrong.
It's fun.
It's like M57 conversions. I'm not a huge fan. But
okay,
everyone thinks that's the way that
controversial.
Yeah, that should like go.
The hot ticket at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
So we were speaking earlier, weren't we, before we recorded the podcast, and we were talking about the Ford engine.
Yeah, the TDCR. Yeah.
Which obviously it's only there because Ford owned Jaguar at one point, so there was a link between the two.
But there's a lot of people out there that say they're junk and they don't own a place in Land Rover. Yeah. But what do you think?
I like the Puma. I think I've still got the world's most powerful, but I like Puma, but unfortunately it doesn't like poor servicing. So if you don't look after it, it's not going to look after you. It doesn't like it. There's definitely issues is the wrong word. There's common things that do fail, but there's been common things on all Land Rover engines that fail. It's no different. I think a lot of the time modern, I don't mean to sound harsh, but I think the modern home mechanic sometimes isn't quite up to date with the technology level. So right. They off slate something because they don't really understand what's happening.
In the same way that people slate certain parts because they've spent nothing on them, fitted them wrong, and then they can...
Yeah, and it's the parts' fault and it's not...
Yeah, interesting.
Because like back in the day, TD5 used to get slated, or you can't have a Land Rover with an ECU, yet now apparently that's Land Rover's best ever engine.
Yeah.
But let's move on. People look through history with raised tinted glasses, don't they?
Yeah.
But the whole, like... Obviously, tuning's been around forever, but what people are now doing with TD5s, like making them run standalone, yeah, and putting them in anything that moves.
It's nothing that new. I think sometimes there's quite a few companies, which I perhaps put myself into a little bit, that did stuff early in the day, and now it's coming back all the way around, and I think, well, I've done that. We did that years ago.
Right.
I suppose it's the next generation coming in.
Yeah.
They're finding it for themselves. And then...
Well, things are also...
They've reinvented the wheel.
Quite possibly, yeah. I guess also economics come into it a lot as well. Yeah. Stuff becomes more affordable.
Well, the cars become more affordable. People are willing to go that further with them now.
Yeah. Talking of going far with cars, the Defenders in here are like...
I was just going to say, we're sitting here and just wanted to know a bit more about what's going on because there's, what, three vehicles in here at the minute?
Yeah, just the ones outside. But
yeah, the ones outside. Oh.
Inside there's three. So there's a 2015 Defender 110 that's in for air suspension. It's in for new glow LED lights and a few other upgrades. So he's got VBS suspension and Fox dampers, different anti-roll bars, and basically try to make it as comfortable as possible. And then there's a series build, which is another one of the Puma-powered Series 2As.
Oh, is that getting a Puma?
Yeah, that'll be getting a Puma.
Oh, wow.
So galvanised chassis upwards. And then there's another 110 that I think he's literally got every accessory he could possibly think of and gone, let's fit this into this car.
When you gave me like a quick rundown on that one, I was blown away because it is like essentially looks like a Defender, but the amount of tech in it is like a completely different animal to anything I've seen before.
Basically. it is the level of text. Like, for example, it's got an ARB Lynx. So the ARB Lynx is a standalone controller. You've got a little control box under the seat that you put all your accessories into. Then you use a phone like an app and you can turn things on and off. But it's even got like a tyre pressure, so you can tell you what pressure you want. And then the tyre pump will turn on, will inflate or deflate to get that pressure. So you don't have to look at it and hold the valve on.
Oh, well.
It'll do it for you.
Wow. It's, yeah, and like the amount of extra wiring, like you look, obviously the interior is a part at the moment.
It was the wiring. I peered through the window earlier and I saw the wiring all out. I don't know how you get your head around it.
I don't either. I just make it up. It's going to happen, yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole, like, well, probably more wiring in there now than there was, like, double the amount of original wiring easily.
Does it scare you, though, that car's carrying so much tech in what is otherwise a...
No, I find it interesting. I like the fact that customers come to me and ask me to build stuff like that. The downside is sometimes I go home thinking, oh, I'd really like that on my car, but I've
got no time here.
No, exactly. No
one else's.
My own car, I'd never buy a car from a mechanic. Well, I'm not a mechanic, actually. I hate that term, but...
Well, what would you class
it as? Well, I've done it.
Yeah. You are an engineer, aren't you, to be fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, so how do you distribute your time between, so there's three in here now. How do you work
badly,
that one?
Badly, generally, but I just try and do a few days a week and split between, so it'd be a few days a week doing normal quick turnaround stuff and tuning, and then a few days a week doing the longer term builds.
Yeah. So if somebody came to you now with a car with mad ideas and this, that and the other, you know, is it kind of months waiting list, or is it?
A big build would be 12 months waiting list.
Really? Wow. Crikey. I suppose it's a blessing and a curse being sort of a one-man band, isn't it? Because on the one side, you've obviously got total control and you know what's happening and when. But yeah, like trying to get stuff done must be difficult.
Yeah, it is hard. The pay is my wife's going to come and help me with some of the admin stuff just to make life a bit easier for me. Because at the time, it's answering the phone, it's emails, and that does get in the way sometimes. Sometimes you'll get a customer trying to phone you and you'll phone like 50 times and you think, I've got a gearbox out. I'm just trying to get it back in.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
We know firsthand when we've tried to get a hold of you.
Oh, yeah. It's true. I can't deny that. It's
probably the worst person to get a hold of in the entire land of community.
Elusive.
But probably looking at this workshop, probably one of the busiest. You know?
In terms of Defender, I don't generally work on anything other than Defender and Series now.
Right.
I'm not interested in... I do the odd few bits on new Defender, but reality, 95% of my customer base is old Defender.
Okay. That's great, though, because it shows people are still really pushing the envelope with what they're doing with them. Like you said,
it doesn't seem an end to it, does there?
No.
Kind of like it's...
Well, no, I think people see it's a challenge to go further.
Yeah. Once that one's finished with all the air suspension and every single... Someone else will come along, no doubt, and say,
yeah,
I would have done it like this.
How do I
build more? And obviously doing that, I'll do something. I think, actually, if I did it again, I wouldn't do it that way. So you always learn, aren't you? Every day's a school day. It's...
Crikey. So then, money no object and time on your hands, what Land Rover would you build for yourself? What's the...
I'd have two.
Okay.
So...
Who wouldn't?
Ignoring how many I actually own. I think day-to-day, I've got a 110 Puma, 2.2 Puma. Day-to-day, it's a brilliant car.
Okay.
I love it. And then there's a big list of stuff I'd do to it, but I just don't get time.
So what would you say, like, from somebody looking at a standard car, what's the number one thing that you'd say is the huge improvement?
I'm biased. I go tuning and performance.
In fairness, I mean, you've had yours done. I've had my daily driver done, not by self, but...
No.
Sorry about that.
Tuners are available.
Yeah. But yeah, it does really, really make a huge difference.
It does. Of course, you've got to understand the manufacturers are limited what they can do. So vehicle performance is hugely dictated by emissions.
Yeah.
So a manufacturer can't do that much. So they have to stay within a set window. And obviously outside of that window, there's people like me and other tuners that will push that envelope further to make the car drive better.
It does transform them when they've had a bit of...
I suppose they're limited by the emissions in a testing and a development sense.
Yes,
because... Like, I've never heard of apart from maybe like a TD5 with a purposefully smoky map, which I'm against anyway. I've never heard of a car failing MOT on a remap, on a tune.
No, it shouldn't do. But if you imagine it, a diesel MOT test is opacity only. So a diesel MOT doesn't look at any emissions. At the moment, they keep trying to change it. It doesn't look at any emissions other than opacity. So all it looks at is smoke.
Right.
So actually, you can do quite a bit without you being picked up on the MOT test. Whereas if you did a European drive cycle, for example, straight away you'd see the fact that it's not standard.
Interesting. Okay.
So talking about modified vehicles, it's probably a good time to hear from our sponsors.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
So you've got a fairly interesting collection of stuff yourself, haven't you? Whether you've got time to work on it,
yeah,
that's a whole other thing.
That's the problem. I collect all these nice Land Rovers and they don't get it done. Because ultimately, a customer car pays my mortgage.
Yeah.
And it pays for my nice things and nice cars, but it's getting time to do them. But no, I have got a bit of a mix of Land Rovers. I think sometimes you see all these Land Rover specialists and they drive a BMW or an Audi. They don't actually drive the product. Whereas I quite like the brand, as in I drive them myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you got other like personal daily cars other than the 110, or is that like you're doing?
No. So Transit, custom van and a Mini.
Okay, but fair enough.
Nothing that exciting.
But, it serves a purpose, doesn't it?
It does.
Frees up the money from all Land Rovers. But yeah, you've actually got, is it chassis number one Ford control?
Yeah, so I've got the 1962 launch car, so chassis number one of the UK petrol right-hand drive Ford controls.
Wow.
Which came from a bloke who owned it, lived down in Heathrow, and he was selling his house, and we went down and emptied his garden, and I had to buy several Land Rovers to get number one.
How many?
Seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
Right.
So I think there's a Bates conversion, which is a full control done by an external company in Evesham.
Right.
So that'd be magazine featured a few times, a little cut down thing, and that still exists. It's just had a new owner. There was a Carmichael file engine as well, which is now up in Manchester. There was three Range Rover Classics, and there was two A full controls. So right. The chassis number one being one of them.
It's quite a thing, isn't it? We were having a little look around it earlier. You've obviously got another one as well, which is a donor, is it?
Yeah, so number one, it's quite rare because it had a fixed side body. So normally, full control, the sides drop down so you can load stuff on. But number one, it had a fixed side body. So I managed to get a brochure from the 1962 Earls Court Motor Show launch, and it talks about my car being on the stand.
Oh,
wow. So it tells you the spec of it. It was £1,050 brand new. It's a 2.25 petrol. It tells you all about it.
That's mega.
And then if you look at the original owner, it comes back as being shipped out from Rover to the Earls Court team. They give it some term, but yeah, it was shipped out.
So long-term project then, really?
It is. It's one of them. One day I think I should just sell it because it's just sitting there. It's not necessarily degrading anymore, but it's sad to see it sat there. But on the other hand, I'm never going to get number one of something again. It's that dilemma.
That's the thing with having, you've got a bit of space outside here.
So yeah, unfortunately.
That is an unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, we were saying about money and time and space.
The project trial, yeah. Money, time, space.
If you've got the space, it's when do you ever drag that in here?
Yeah.
And you've got customer cars.
That's the thing. So I keep thinking I should just sell it. But then the whole question is, how much is it worth? Because it's number one. Although the Ford Control has never been the most popular Land Rover because they're a bit interesting to drive, it's still number one of a certain type.
Mm.
And it's how do you put a value on that? I don't know.
I suppose everything's for sale at the right price.
Exactly.
If anyone wants to email editorial@lrn.co.uk.
It'd make a very interesting article. They can have the donor car, yeah, or the bits you'll need.
I was going to say, it's probably going to be a sort of a less bitter pill to swallow if you know that it would go away to someone who's going to pour love on
Either see it scrapped or sat around. It's
yeah.
I don't think he'll ever get scrapped.
No.
Because there's only one of one, isn't there? So it's, yeah. But we're saying in the podcast a couple of podcasts ago, we said, when was the last time you saw one?
I know, you don't.
I said, I've got two.
Yeah.
Yeah, like buses.
But then, there's also the thing then about, if I restored number one, it's all concourse. Well, I don't think I'd go fully concourse. I think you try and keep a bit of its originality as possible. But then if you drive it down the road and someone crashed into it, I'd be gutted. It would almost be too rare to use. I don't know if it crosses that threshold or not. Because you see these collectors with cars and they put them in a garage because they don't want to use them.
Mm.
Because what happens to it, it's...
And if that's the only thing they've put all their love and attention into,
It's even more precious.
Because back in the day, I really fancied having a go at Comp Safari, and I thought, right, I'm going to build myself a really nice car. But then if I crashed it, I'd be devastated because we put all that work and time and effort into it.
So you're not going to race it to
competitiveness,
are you?
No, a little bit. I find that hard sometimes, but
I guess people say online, don't they? All these cars are lovely, but they never get driven. They're not used for what they're supposed to. But when you, like you say, it's time and effort. When you're hours and hours and hours into something that you absolutely adore, you're not going to put it at risk.
I know, at the end of the day, it's only metal. It's just a car, isn't it? But it's just getting over that threshold if you actually wanting to use it.
A fine line, isn't it? Mm. But so let's talk about the Series 2A with the TDCi, because that's sort of like, we've sort of got a bit of a thing at the moment, haven't we, for modernised. We talked about the TDCi 110 over there with all the late tech in it. That's sort of the same concept, but on a much, much earlier car.
I think there's certain car restorers, I don't want to mention them, but there's a company that restores Series 1 Land Rovers. And a lot of their customers would complain that they drive badly, not realising that's how a Series 1 drives or a Series 2 drives. So you could restore it back to concourse, someone would drive it and think, that drives like a bag of nails. It's horrible. And it's not. It's how he drove back in the day. And because cars have evolved, people don't realise that there's no synchro mesh, there's no power steering, there's no servo brakes. So the idea of the Series 2A was to make something that looked like a classic car, but actually drove in a more modern way that was safer. It got better brakes, better steering, better performance, but it still had that character of a Series 2A.
Yeah, I was going to say, bodywork-wise, it's still, like, it's got a nice patina on it and it doesn't look, you know, anything...
Well, as a passing glance, you'd just think it was a Series 2A, you wouldn't know.
So for those who haven't seen it in Land Rover Monthly, A, where have you been? And B, it's powered by a 2.2, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So it's got 2.2 TDCi engine gearbox. It's got the LT230 transfer box, but it's on its original series axles, but with a disc brake conversion. It's still leaf sprung. That's the most important criteria, that it's still an original chassis type, an original suspension type.
Yeah, so yeah, it's still got the main sort of characteristic of a series, which is its leaf sprung.
It's a series that will sit all day long at 90 mile an hour if you were so inclined.
Really?
It's quite phenomenal.
I bet actually, given how, I mean, there's a fair weight difference between the series and the Defender. I bet it scoots along quite well, doesn't it?
But you do. So the current owner took it on the Scram Rally. And it was with a 90 and a 110, well, two 90s and 110s. And actually, because it's so light, it just skimmed along. The Defenders couldn't keep up at times.
Is it permanent four-wheel drive?
Yeah, permanent four-wheel drive. So it's got Brian Bush in Design Development. He does a stage one spec front axle kit. So swivels, CVs and shafts. It's got all Brian's kit in the front end. So it's permanent four-wheel drive.
Got you. Yeah, I should think that helps as well, doesn't it? Especially on sand.
And then it's got a P38 steering box, which is very good, actually. It's a very good steering box. It's an impressive little toy.
Stuff. And that's in for a bit of love, isn't it? I believe
it. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Then he's off again to Morocco later this year doing the Santana Trophy.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Yeah, we've got a feature in a, well, ongoing build-up of a 110, actually, which is going to be competing in that in the Land Rover Monthly, which is quite exciting.
And there's another car here, isn't there? Also going into Santana.
That's... Is it Scram or something?
No, Santana. Yeah.
Is it? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, the pub around the back, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry, I got confused for a second.
So it seems like we're the only people not doing the Santana.
All the rally cars are being built here.
And then obviously there's another two that are supposed to be built this year at some point, which is another 2A powered, Puma powered series. But they're going to be slightly different because they're having all new panels. So the bodywork will be brand new, basically. So right. They'll look like a newer car, but still with a characteristic of a 2A.
Yeah, it's no wonder you've got no time to do your own stuff.
No. And then I've got, because it tucked away in the container, there's a 1952 Minerva, so a Belgian-built Series 1, which is like the poor man Series 1, because they don't fetch the money of a normal UK car, but it's great fun. It's just different. No one knows what it is when you take it to shows, because they look so different.
They're quite odd at the front, aren't they?
Yeah, I really like them, I think.
It's really angular.
I've driven one then, and they're just like Series 1. Yeah. They're no different.
They're actually a bit more comfortable, because they're heavier. They sit down a bit more, and they actually ride a bit better.
Yeah, okay.
I was then, when I drove one, it was at the Land Rover Experience at Solihull.
Yeah, they've got one there, haven't they?
Yeah, I drove that one.
But they're sort of half the price of a UK car. Well, they've gone up a little bit, but they're about half the price of a UK car.
Jake Schulheifer, who's done a bit for us, has got one as well. Yeah, I think he's putting a V8 in it. Good man.
Oh, that's not bad.
Big fuzz. Fuzz has got one as well. It's got a wooden bed on the back, so it's done as a little pickup.
Oh, right.
I've not seen that.
Yeah, I think he's got that tucked away.
Nice.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, we haven't really touched on the fact that you're, you've been gracious enough to sort of open up your business to featuring in the tech section of LRM over the years. You've sort of struck up quite a good relationship with Alistair, the photographer, and he comes over and sort of documents jobs that we then in the pages, which is, really
good. It's just good. I quite enjoy it. It was good.
Not too much awkward posing.
No. He makes you wear funny underwear sometimes.
Does it? Or no underwear.
No underwear. But
that's only not around on the weekends.
Yeah, it's
unrelated.
Unrelated to LRM, yeah.
No, I think there's quite a few tech features, I think. And I think there's some more coming soon as well. In the works.
Yeah, keep an eye out for that. It's good. It's all good stuff. The tech section is still a massive part of the magazine and one that we know people flock to because it can be trusted. It's not like any old rubbish when you ask a question on the internet. It's proper information with integrity, isn't it?
And I think a lot of the tech stuff is the cars that people own now as well. In reality, if you did a carburetor swap on a Series 1, it probably wouldn't be to that many readers, whereas doing stuff on a Puma or a late 35 is a bit more relevant.
Definitely.
Yeah, we've definitely tried to keep with the times, haven't we?
Mm.
Yeah.
With the tech stuff.
That's it, isn't it? It's trying to preempt what people are going to be doing currently and over the next few years, and trying to get in and providing that information that can be relied on, which is obviously a challenge and it's hard work, but it's good. It's good.
Well, after today, I know what you're going to be doing over the next few
weeks. Can I mention that, though? His wife's listening.
She has actually discovered the podcast and she's listened to quite a few episodes.
See, my wife still hasn't listened to one.
Is she not?
No. So I can say anything I like about her. She's not had it.
Yeah, but like I went for...
Once it's out there though, isn't it?
Exactly. My wife hadn't listened to any for months and months and months. And then all of a sudden it's like she's binging it when she's like doing stuff. And I'm like, why are you listening to me and Steve waffling about Land Rovers? You've absolutely no interest in Land Rovers at all. Apart from seeing them turn up on the driveway now and again. Yeah. Less said about that, the better. But no, I'll definitely be... Although we have come to a gentleman's agreement that your 90 will get priority before this thing that I've...
That was a very gentlemanly agreement.
Yes. I've got to try and stick to it now.
You have. Because I've been getting organised with that, you know? And, been digging out all my bits and pieces, stuff that I've...
getting the ball rolling.
Yeah. Plans for the foot, so it's good.
You'll see more on that soon on YouTube.
It means spending money, unfortunately, which is painful.
But for the greater good, at least the thing will be moving forward.
Exactly.
Yeah. But
you've had experience with one of the cars lately as well, haven't you?
Can
we talk about that? The supercharged one?
Yes. Oh, heavens above. That
was because you boys had a bit of
I haven't actually meant... I'll keep forgetting where we are in podcast land and where the real world is. But yeah, we went to Richard Hammond's gaff on Saturday just gone, didn't we? The smallest cog. He had a Land Rover meet up and drive out and basically put word out on Instagram and then people could apply and then buy tickets. And it was a really cool day, wasn't it?
It was. I think they had about 500 applicants and accepted 25 cars.
It was a really, really good variety.
It was a slight oversight that we all met a car park with a height barrier.
So yeah.
Nearly everyone couldn't get in.
Oh, right. Okay.
I think there was like a little lightweight or a series.
Because Richard walks under the height barrier and realised it wasn't an issue.
Everything was like modified or lifted or like there was a lot of tall Land Rover, even standard Defenders, I don't think, got underneath.
And a very tall 2B4 control.
Very tall, yeah. You've probably seen that at the shows. The sort of black and white forward control with
cottage
on the back.
Oh, it's got a name. I can't think what it's called.
Is it Zeb?
Zeb something?
Zebedee?
Something like that.
I don't know.
It's still very cool.
It's got like a listed building behind this. Anyway, it couldn't... Yeah. Yes, you're right. Everyone turned up
and didn't see it. It'd be at LRM Live.
Yeah, it will be. It was, everyone had to park on the grass essentially at the meeting point because there was a height barrier.
Yeah.
But no, from there, we went and did a drive around that lovely town.
Is that Ross-on-Wye?
Yeah, that was it. Sorry.
Near where my land
is. I'm sure all the locals loved it, yeah. Three laps of the circuit. All those locals looking a bit funny, yeah.
I don't know. I think people quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, they did.
They were.
They're looking Ross-on-Wye.
They were videoing. Yeah. I'm not sure that was because they were approved or because they were either confused or going to call the police.
Yeah. All these Land Rovers, they must be lost.
But it was great. And then went to a farm, didn't we? There's like an off-road track around a private ground on a farm.
All bar one Land Rover went round, I think, because the one we were in was a little bit too shiny.
Okay.
So he didn't do the off-road bit.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was really cool. The first time I've ever seen a Series 180 inch sort of a bit sideways.
Yeah, CKP way it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Rams, yeah, I've seen that.
Absolutely flat out.
Yeah, the social medias.
Yeah.
And a very, what looked like, I don't think it was actually top heavy, but a very tall 130, which I'm pretty sure did a lap.
Yeah,
on.
Bill's car, yeah.
It was getting a bit of a lean on. I think there was probably some nail-biting moments, but yeah, and then back to the smallest cog where we all had bacon sandwiches and coffee and chatted and whatever else.
Yeah, looked about everyone's cars and we revved the supercharger V8 out a few times, which some people liked.
So did you build it?
Yeah, so one of my customers bought an LS3-powered 90 soft top. So it already got the LS3 in it and the soft top conversion. But I always find it a bit odd that you've put this 430 horsepower engine into a Defender and you've left everything else standard. So apart from a set of springs, it was on standard brakes, it was on standard diffs, it was on probably not the best tyres. And you think you've created this monster that is quite fast compared to what it should be, and you haven't upgraded anything else.
Okay.
So I find it a little bit worrying sometimes.
I was going to say, it wasn't supercharged when he bought it, was it?
No, it wasn't. No, so it was a Crate LS3 engine, so 430 horsepower out of the box. Let's put it into a Defender.
I was going to say, quite fast is an understatement now. Now that it's supercharged, the thing is absolutely unhinged.
So what horsepower is that?
So 680 horsepower, 880 newton meters.
It's a 90.
I was cracking. So a 90 soft top, but we sort of went through it. So diffs have been changed. It's got ATB peg differentials. It's got overrated drive shafts, overrated prop shafts. It's got attractive electronic suspensions. So you can change the settings on the fly. And then once we basically made it safe, and we put a roll cage in it as well now, once we made it safe, we put the supercharger on and then wound it up a little bit.
Okay.
So I think with that
makes nice noise.
It's mind-bendingly fast.
I think with the little draggy on, so the little GPS timer, we were at 3.7 seconds to 60.
But it's nice because it isn't like what we said before about like the 20-inch alloys and like it looks, it's got a real nice classic look to it. In fact, it was on our stand on the Sunday at LRM Live last year.
Really 90.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
It doesn't look very much as a passive dance.
Do you know what it doesn't? I know what you mean, understated.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's not too shouty.
Do you want another one?
Yeah, of course.
But the interior is gorgeous on really it well, isn't it? It's all like really nicely done leather dash and trim and a custom center console with push button gear selection. Mm. And it's really, really smart.
But it's odd because it's got so much power, but you could drive around it and it's just docile. You can putt around in it. Perhaps not doing the most of the gallon, but you could putt around and use it every day. And then the moment you stab the throttle,
it comes alive.
It does.
Yeah.
There has been mention of us racing against the electric Defender from the Classic Electric Defender Classic Electric Car Company. Because I think they're claiming 3.5 seconds to 60 in their electric car.
Is that the one that we saw?
At so the little green
horse.
Yes.
Electric.
Yeah,
that was quick. It'll be a good matchup, I think.
Yeah, I think we need to arrange a little drag.
That'd make a decent video, yo.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, we should. Yeah. We should get them for a head-to-head. I said to the fella who owns it, I said, "Really, you need to get this up the strip at Sandapod where it will grip properly."
Yeah,
because that would be impressive.
What would be embarrassing is what if the petrol lost?
Well, it would and it wouldn't, because we all know what an electric motor like. They're incredibly torquey and like instant response. So, but you've got to put. The question I would ask, instead of is it faster, yes or no, would you have more fun driving a supercharged LS3 or something with an electric motor?
Don't know.
Probably.
I know what.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, it's a noise.
It is a noise. Yeah, he doesn't like a V8.
It's got switchable exhaust as well.
Yeah, so it's got an active exhaust. So you've got a little sport button, well, ASBO button on the dash, and you press it and it opens the valve.
Yeah, I was amazed at how, for a soft top as well, so it does, like, at certain speeds, you do get that bit of soft top flap, but if you open the window a little bit, all the air equalises, and it is very quiet at speed.
Okay. So the downside now is, one thing we'll talk about briefly with the cars I've got, I've got a Puma 90 that's sat in my container that used to be the most powerful 2.4 Puma, and then unfortunately we took it apart to make more power, and the one of my best friends we did a lot of work with, he passed away. And my original block now, I don't know where it is. So I've got a very late Puma with no engine. And after doing the LSL supercharge, I want to build a V8 track day Defender and try and break the 1,000 horsepower barrier. But
Wow.
That might be a pipe dream. But
is that a 90 as well?
Yeah.
Crikey.
Yes, 2010 Puma that I've owned from new. It's a nice little thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I said 1,000 horsepower and a Defender. It's all a bit much, isn't it? But
you can never have too much. It's fine.
I mean, well, like I say, riding in the passenger seat of that supercharged LS3 one, it pushes you really hard back into the seat, and the driver's like, oh, yeah, it was like half throttle. Yeah. Not even ringing it out.
No, no.
Just incredible power.
That's the great thing about Defenders, though, isn't it? That's not everyone's cup of tea, by any sense. But there's that market for everyone, that everyone likes different things.
I think that's the beauty of Land Rover.
I mean, definitely.
Yeah.
100%.
Because everything in here is completely different.
Yeah. And everything else. This is all different.
Yeah.
But then you'll get someone come in and go, oh, I really like the lights on that one. I love the lights. Or I really like the headlights. Or I like the seats. Not everyone's going to have everything in one package.
Again, we always say we're completely spoilt, really, for the amount of stuff, aftermarket stuff in general, that is catered for in Land Rovers. I don't think there's another brand with the same level of customizability. I know.
Well, Volkswagen stuff is similar, but it's not on one model, especially.
Yeah.
Because if you ran all 91 10s into that Defender bracket, there's a huge list of stuff you could do to them.
Mad. You could just, I mean, like, money no object. You could have, I don't know, 15 Defenders, all the slightly different spec, and yeah, that you customize yourself.
Users. Yeah, you would. Yeah.
It's not good. Long may it continue, I say.
Yeah, and keep buying LRN.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Keep fueling.
Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. Keep reading about all these interesting cars, then.
Yeah, absolutely. It shows no sign of slowing down, which is a great sign for everyone involved in the Land Rover scene.
Yeah, because I think sometimes it does get slightly harder, though, because I don't think a lot of readers will realise how much stuff that Land Rover have turned off. So you go to order parts for Land Rover and you can't get them anymore. So there's people like Britpart, for example, that help massively by actually still having stuff made that's in the market. Because it's amazing now, if you've got a Land Rover Microcat and front seats, for example, I've had to order a set of front seats for a customer's Defender, no longer available. So Land Rover cannot supply front seats for that particular Defender.
Is that because they don't see the demand for it?
Exactly, yeah, there's right. Demand.
Okay.
But like TD5 fuel filters, you can't buy a genuine fuel filter anymore.
Really?
Land Rover stopped making.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Land Rover turned, they didn't make them themselves, but they turned off that production line.
You'd think something like,
I didn't even think about it.
High volumes of fuel filter, though, you'd think they would carry on.
Because I'm finding more and more now, you go to order parts and you go to Land Rover's website and Marcat, and you go through like JLR EPC as it is now, and it'll be a super CD part number, and you click on it, no longer available. You move from service. And there's lots of parts now that are getting harder to find because Land Rover don't supply them anymore.
That's so surprising. And, I mean, thankfully, we are backed up by lots of other OE equivalent.
Yeah.
But if you're one of those people who's got maybe a car you've had from new and really low mileage, and you might want the proper genuine parts with the label on,
yeah,
it's mad to think that's not an option anymore.
Because it's even daft things as well that you wouldn't think of that you go to order, even like a random fitting, no longer available. Or Land Rover runs stock down and there's a bracket on the wing on a Defender and it's literally a right angle piece of metal. That's 80 quid now from Land Rover.
What?
And it's literally a right angle piece of metal. And obviously you get a big part and you can buy it for £12, but Land Rover have just ramped the price up because they're obviously getting low on stock.
Weird.
Kind of around.
Crazy the way things work, isn't it? But
if you imagine, they went from building all these cars, so all these suppliers had, they almost relied on Defender production, that when it stopped, Land Rover, as any manufacturer, they've got to support certain parts for 10 years, but obviously we're at the end of that 10-year period now, so more and more stuff is going to start disappearing.
Just the past 9 years, haven't we?
I suppose so. Yeah, coming on to 10 years since it went out of production.
Yeah, because I think that from emissions point of view, they're supposed to support some parts for 10 years, but other stuff they can stop earlier.
Scary stuff. I was amazed that the Freelander 2 now classes as on their classic parts portal. Freelander 2? It's like a new car.
In your mind.
Yeah, it is.
That's true. I still look at like my Defender 2010. I think it's not that old.
No, I know.
It's 15 years old now.
Discovery 3s even still look kind of modern compared to anything.
They've been on their classic parts list for a long time.
Yeah, I know.
But even those, there's some bits you can't get anymore.
Wow.
The stuff gets turned off. Because I've got a Storm Recovery Defender in here at the moment, which is one I've been trying to order the seats for. And I was chatting to the assurance assessor. It's not just Land Rover, but there's lots of parts manufacturers you can't get bits for. But he was saying he's got like Range Rovers that have been Storm Recovered and the people can't get parts. They're just not available.
That storm recovery we were talking about, that's quite worrying, actually, what I've seen on there.
I think unfortunately that the customer was a little bit naive. Though I've tried to tell him and educate him about he needs to put layers of security in. I think he was a little bit naive. So
to steal that car, they've come to the top of the wing, haven't they? Peel it back.
Yeah, to try and find the alarm sounder.
Amazing, the damage that they've caused just to... And it wasn't there.
No.
I'll never ever forget, obviously, when I worked on Land Rover owner turning up to where we were based and seeing the grey Defender TDCi utility completely stripped. Just turning up and no headlights in it, back window smashed, parts missing all over the place. People are just... They're brazen. The criminals, if they want stuff, they'll just...
Unfortunately, though, the Land Rover market is half the problem, though, because if there's no supply and demand, the stuff wouldn't get... You'd never see a Hyundai get pinched because there's no market for the parts.
Yeah. In fact, you see pictures from, like, music festivals and that where the front of an L405 is missing.
Yeah.
Because, like, crashed L405s need repair, front-end repair parts, so they're stolen off good cars and the Falcon and sold it. Absolutely terrifying. I mean, the lengths people will go to.
Because like that Defender outside, they've disabled the alarm and all they've done is pushed it 100 metres down the road, just found somewhere quiet, took it into, then took all the interior.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Pond life. I hate thieves.
It is. But I think sometimes people, they don't realise that you need to have more than one device to protect your own vehicle, which rightly or wrongly.
Security is unfortunately one of the most boring things you can spend your money on, but one of the most important.
Mm.
It's not, no one looks forward to buying a load of security stuff, do they? But
no.
If you want to protect what you've invested time and love into, then unfortunately it's a necessary evil, isn't it?
Because unfortunately, you protect your own car, it just means they'll go and find another one down the road, but
you can't help that. Weaker.
Yeah.
Weaker too. If one has a steering, old-fashioned... Disclaimer is not something like that, and one hasn't, they're going to try for the one that hasn't.
Yeah,
so it's deterrence.
Anyway, should we finish this on a slightly more positive note?
Oh, yeah.
What's in the works, Ian? What can we look forward to in future from you? Got any big ideas you're working on?
Well, 1,000 horsepower is quite
fast. Yeah, 1,000 horsepower is a nice thing.
What about kill two birds with one stone, do you supercharge LS3 in your Series 2A4 control?
Criminal,
yeah.
Can you imagine driving that?
The visit council said, love that, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
take it to Santa Claus.
Chassis number one, just casually packing a huge GM V8.
It's not a bad check, though.
Could you do it to the donor?
You could do it to the donor, but I always think about how you could make the car safe, though, because unfortunately, giving you big power is one area of it, but you need to make it stop and handle.
Yeah.
And you'd never make a series stop and handle on leaf springs. You'd start getting axle wrap. With the little Puma-powered series, if you hoof it, the spring actually twists, so you get axle wrap, so you start feeling it bouncing to your steering.
I'm amazed, actually. Obviously, we've got parabolics on my 109 now, and that's only got a low-compression V8, but I can feel the rear axle doesn't tramp, but you can feel the twist, and you could never feel it with the old multi-leaf springs. So, yeah, with any sort of real power,
it was the rust holding it together, that was, just stopped it. It
probably was, yeah. It's like having anti-wrap bars.
Yeah, never had the suspension in it before.
No, that's horrible.
No. I did used to just lash engine oil over them, but it didn't really free them. The fronts I rebuilt, the rears I didn't, and probably should have, but there you go. Well, thanks again for having us.
Sorry.
Keep an eye on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely for chat, really. It's all good.
Yeah, it's nice to catch up to see what's going on. And keep an eye on the podcast. Subscribe, leave a little review, because there's going to be a lot more. We're going to have a lot more guests on this year, aren't we?
I hope so.
We are.
Otherwise, they have to listen to us to have it on.
It's in the works, Stevie. Don't you worry.
Can you worry? It's a little bit on, yeah. It's fine.
I don't see much of that.
Yeah. Well, there you go. A great cure for insomnia. What more could you want from a podcast? Anything to add, or shall we just
say... No, you can leave it there.
Oh, brilliant.
I'm going to get warmed up, because it's not the warmest workshop.
No, it's not.
It is quite chilly, but you do make a good coffee. So thanks again for having us, and
thank you very much.
Catch you on the next one.
Bye for now.